This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
So the Communications and Multimedia Minister, Gobind Singh Deo, has said all Malaysians may soon have a national digital ID, and they're looking to develop this because they want to create a platform of trust in cyberspace to eliminate elements of fraud and cheating. We have, of course, been talking about cybercrimes and scams for much of the week because the same ministry announced that 300 million ringgit has been lost.
Just from January.
Till right now, yes.
Exactly. In these 10 months, it's been 300 million ringgit. Now, I think it's important to point out that this announcement from Gobind Singh Deo, this is very different from the One Malaysia email thing that was rolled out many, many years ago by the BN government, which was kind of fell into a shambles, right? I mean, this is more like a digital signature of sorts. Is probably the best way I can describe it. And at the moment, if you want to do anything in Malaysia, anything at all, if you want to sign up for stuff, if you want to buy stuff, everyone takes a copy of your MyCard, right? They ask if they can take a photocopy of your MyCard. And that's not necessarily something that is entirely secure. It's probably not best that photocopies of your MyCard are going around because God knows we've seen those photocopies being used for fraud and e-crimes as well.
Yes.
And so what this does is when you create a secure ID, it's a lot like when you use your fingerprint on your iPhone or your Samsung to unlock your phone or your Face ID. It's that. It's an encrypted key, if you will, that can be used for a lot of different things.
So that sounds great in terms of convenience, right?
Yes,
and in terms of, in theory, security. But that notion of security is one that we also need to talk about and interrogate simply because, increasingly, the world of cyberspace is, it doesn't feel as secure as we were once promised it would be. I mean, there are all these situations where you hear of hacking being on the rise, where you hear of data drops and data hacks happening with large companies whom, you know, you assume, well, you've paid the best of the best. We figure that you've got your security locked down and we trust you. And there have been enough of those occasions where that trust hasn't been rewarded, where you think, okay, I don't know if I want to go down this road again.
Okay, so here's my biggest concern with something like this. It's exactly what you mentioned, Lynn, but also we've had multiple security breaches and there have been no updates as to what has happened since then. Before the elections, there was that huge data breach that was being talked about. Mobile numbers, medical information, a lot of stuff. There was a lot of talk that it had gone through the Middle East and the we still have no resolution to how that leak or data breach happened, right? There are tons of rumors about how secure even our banking information is, and I think we're waiting to get to the bottom of all of this. So if I have a lack of trust in these institutions to which I'm giving my data, these local institutions, then they're really going to have to up their game before something like this, which can be used to cover all of my dealings on a national level, gets implemented, right?
And whether or not that upping of the game can happen before it's going to be implemented next year, I think that's also an important aspect because when it rolls out, you want it to roll out fully formed or at least very close to being fully formed.
It's so not that, something you can take a risk on.
No, not at all. and also just from the government's point of view, while we are continuously talking about how much or how little is being spent here and there, again, it's not a gamble that can be taken where you push a lot of money into this and no one ends up using it. So that's another aspect of this. To get a better understanding of what this national digital ID would encompass, we've got Matt Armitage of Culture Pop with us on the line. Matt, thank you for joining us. Can you help us understand what this ID would be?
Well, it's not really that much different from having an email address that the government uses to contact you. So it's really just a secure communication channel between you and the government. In the past, we've relied on things like, you know, obviously normal letters and using ICs and identity cards and passports and all that kind of stuff. This is just a way of making that a little bit more secure and making that transaction a bit more direct. So it's, you know, it's not a letter that's sent to your house and can be misappropriated or not delivered or sent to the wrong address, all of this kind of thing. So a lot of countries are actually experimenting with these systems for ways for the government to actually communicate with their citizens.
So what does the minister mean by a verifiable platform of trust?
Well, again, there's that thing of how do you actually communicate with the government? You go into an office, you give them your IC, that proves who you are. If you're accessing government services online, it's through an email address and a password. And of course, those things can be compromised. So in a sense, this is just a way of adding an extra layer of security to those transactions that you have with the government that then make them more secure. So it's verifiable in that it's going to be harder for somebody else to crack your ID that you hold with the government. So it proves that you are that person in a sense without having to go to a government office to show them your ID and get a form stamped.
Okay, so how does this differ from our IC?
Well, this isn't a legal identification. This is a means of communication. So you still have that identity card that you have when you are born. And don't forget, not every country has ID cards. I'm British. There's no identity card system in the UK. The closest we have is our national insurance number, which is a bit similar to the US Social Security number. And that's not a proof of ID. So, you know, it differs from country to country. So in countries where either there is an ID card or there isn't an ID card, this is actually a separate thing. It's not the same as your ID card. I think India is using a similar kind of setup. It allows you to access government services, and it becomes that communication gateway between you and the government.
So will the ID make access and use of government services more linear and efficient? I'm thinking we could use the same ID to access online tax services, EPF, SOXO and the like.
That is potentially the idea. Now, some countries have been successful in delivering that promise, but it then requires all of your government departments to be sharing, if not the same infrastructure and architecture, then at least the same gateway to get into those services. So like I said, it remains to be seen how the government is going to deliver on this scheme, because there are a lot of complications in order to do that. So what you might find is that they might do a sort of scaled down version of that, where each department that you have these transactions with, EPF, SOXO, the Inland Revenue, all of those might have a copy of the database with your ID sign-in so that you can access the services locally within their own network. So it remains to be seen whether all of those services will be put onto the same architecture so that they could kind of share a common footprint with this platform. So at the moment, this is an idea. We have to see a lot more detail, see how it will roll out and how it's actually going to integrate the back end of government services, because that's also an important part of how useful it's going to be to citizens. And of course, when you start talking about integrating lots of government departments, you have a lot of cost on your hands. You have turf wars. There's a lot of interdepartmental politicking to be overcome before that you can actually achieve those aims. I mean, the case in point is Britain's NHS system, which has been trying to put itself on a common IT platform for probably the last 10 or 15 years, and has singularly failed to do that. And that's just within one department, the health department. So you can see what the kind of potential challenges are to try and harmonize all of these different departments under this one ID in this one system.
So we've been hearing some pretty startling numbers when it comes to the issue of cybercrime and cyber fraud. Would a national ID help to combat this problem, and how so?
Well, it does to a certain extent. I mean, it depends how widely that it's adopted and how widely it's used as a watermark to prove that you are the person that you say you are. I mean, it will certainly help in your transactions with the government. Will it help in wider transactions? I'm not really sure. Is it going to be hackable? Well, that's going to depend on the back end that the government puts in place. Who are the partners that are going to be there to be safeguarding the technology? Those are all unknowns and, at this point, unknowable. You really only know if the system can be breached once somebody puts the system up and it's breached. obviously, part of putting that system together is also to involve the so-called white hat hackers, the people who actually do system testing for a living to make sure that it can't be compromised by criminals. So, you know, we're a long way from being able to say whether this system is going to be secure or not. The minister says they have, you know, fantastic people working on it. At this point, we have no choice but to see if the government can actually deliver that security.
Do you think the ID will serve as a better alternative to using the IC card to identify ourselves? I mean, I find the IC is such a contradictory document because it's something that holds so much crucial personal information. But at the same time, we just hand it over and the number and photocopies for everything, right? To get discounts, to sign up for a loyalty card.
Yeah, I mean, as I said to you off air, I've never experienced a country like Malaysia in terms of the willingness to simply trade sensitive data. I mean, people ask, I mean, I signed up today for a loyalty card and they asked me for a passport number. Now, I'm not going to tell you whether that passport number was real or whether that passport number was fake, but you can probably make a fairly good guess because, you know, they don't need to know that level of information about me in order to give me a discount at the shop. If I was in the UK, it simply wouldn't be legal to ask for that information. They would have no right to ask for that information. By the same token, you know, people who ask you to leave your IC at the counter in buildings when you go and register, that's not something I'm comfortable with either. And I've been in many, many arguments with people about that. So certainly this kind of digital ID is a way of replacing that. But yeah, I mean, it is about data security. It is about identity theft. It's about making these systems more secure because, obviously, if you have this kind of digital scan that has a high layer of encryption on it, it's going to be very hard for somebody to actually copy that. So, for example, when you signed up for a service, you would simply scan to verify who you are, but that company doesn't necessarily then take a record of all that information. It's just been given an encryption key that says that you are the person who you say you are. So they don't actually retain any of that information on file that they could then use, for example, to file a fake loan in your name. So there is a much higher level of security involved there. So yes, you could potentially see this digital ID as being the first step towards not necessarily replacing, but just merging your physical ID or IC card with something that is more secure, is based on data rather than having a physical card in your wallet that you present to every Tom, Dick and Harry 17 times a day.
Right. So, Matt, since it's not mandatory to get this national ID, what would incentivize people to sign up?
Well, one of the ways that a lot of other countries have done it have made it mandatory to use if you're accessing government services. So, for example, if you're going online to pay your taxes, if you're receiving social security benefits, if you're receiving reimbursements for health costs, all of this kind of thing, it might be mandatory to have this kind of sign up to receive or make those payments to the government. So that's one way that most countries incentivize because, you know, you don't really want to give someone something to do it. You just want to make it part of the system. So I would imagine we would see something along those lines at some point. All your transactions, all your communications with the government would require this digital ID.
But there is a trust deficit when it comes to the government doing a project like this. I mean, this isn't the first time the government is doing this. Our first attempt at having a national digital ID was that One Malaysia email project. I mean, that flopped because the contract was given to a financially dodgy company, among other reasons. Does the government need sufficient trust from the public for a project like this to take off?
No, I don't think so. I mean, like I said, I think the government just has to demonstrate that this system is robust, whether it uses third-party commercial partners like they tried with the previous example you just mentioned, or whether they do everything in-house. They need to demonstrate that the system is secure, that the system is robust, and that it delivers benefit to consumers, to citizens. So if they do that, then it will make sense for people to sign up. That's why I said, really, it's not about incentivizing this. It's actually about delivery, showing people that there is benefit to having this. And it's not that benefit accrues to a third-party supplier. So it's actually benefit that directly transacts between you and the government in having this digital ID.
Matt, thank you as always for speaking to us. That was Matt Armitage of Culture Pop. You can hear more from him on Tech Talk every Friday at 10 a.m. So yeah, a lot of things to consider there.
So I'm interested as to how that actually plays out, especially with regards to what Matt was saying at the end there with about public trust in the government to pull something like this off, because you need buy-in, right? So the government can do all of that, and even though they've said it isn't mandatory, for it to be truly successful and for people to get excited about it, you need numbers of people actually doing this.
You also need companies and institutions to take it on, because if I join this platform, if I use this platform and it's not actually useful to me in enough places, then
that
it's not going to take off.
Biggest error, right?
Yes. So we've been asking for your thoughts. You can call us at 7733 2900. Do you like this idea of a national digital ID? You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. We've gotten a number of messages. Jay, I don't think this digital ID is a secure one. Our data has been compromised many a time. Do we have the necessary expertise to do this on a large scale? Angain says, a welcome initiative to go digital, so a different perspective, but it's important to keep our cybersecurity infrastructure up to spec as well. As of now, Malaysia's cybersecurity spend is less than 0.1% of the GDP compared to the global average of 0.13. Even as a region, average cybersecurity spend of ASEAN member states are now at 0.06%, and that's expected to grow by 2025. So we're still below the global average, and advanced countries like Japan and the UK with fortified cybersecurity infrastructures spent upwards of 0.2% of GDP on cybersecurity, and we're nowhere close even to the global average. What more, these advanced economies with a more robust cybersecurity infrastructure still are penetrable at times. And then Raul asks the question.
This is the most important question that has been asked so far.
I really feel so.
Yes.
Can the government also make sure we look good in the photo?
Yes.
This gets you buy-in.
Yes.
That's what I'll say. My terrible old IC photo has now been taken for my brand new driving license, and I felt so sad handing over the money for my 5-year license.
No, like, they take the digital photo using the crappy digital camera, and then they kind of stretch you out. And
it's amazing. That camera is amazing for one thing. All humans look like goldfish.
Mm-hmm.
It's really magical. Asmawati says we need to really evaluate the need for a national digital ID, i.e. the ROI, so that it won't be just a project to benefit someone or a company. In the previous administration, it seems like whenever there's a new initiative, the project will benefit a certain person or company. Completely agreed. And I think also, again, with people kind of keeping a close eye on government spend, right?
Yeah.
Where they're choosing to allocate money and attention is so crucial. Is this what we want to see, the national digital ID? I mean, per our listeners, kind of middling?
Well, yeah. So, in many ways, we have these digital IDs, these national IDs or international IDs, if you will. And I think when government set this up, it's actually, in a sense, to take this power away from the Googles, the Facebooks, and the Apples of the world, right? Because right now we use those logins for everything. And with that, they own a lot of power and information and control over our lives. So it's who we want to hand that over to, a private corporation or the government?
That's right. So keep your calls coming. We've also received a number of messages about smoking, or the ban on smoking, rather. We will get to those right after. Seems like it's going to be a hot one. That number to call, 7733 2900. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. Right now, the news, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.